oversimplifying and don't give us the respect of research in those areas. Now, I could prove it at great length with the Grail romances had we spent the last 2 years giving you what I think is the proper interpretation of the Grail romances. And there is no one, as with everything that is done, the minute that the New Testament was written, there were people that tried to take elements of the New Testament story and write spurious departures and tangential interpretations and stories. They would try to use certain pivotal points self-servingly to develop their own themes, giving it credence by mixing some of those factual elements of the New Testament world in. And the task of canonization was to separate the real from the phony. That's Satan's way to come along with the caricature. Well, likewise, the Grail romances, when they came along, served two ends. They served legitimate Christian ends. And they've been taken and twisted out of shape for mystical and Gnostic heretical ends. And they became vehicles for an abundant... How many different cults have utilized the Bible to take off? And it is my personal view that the Merovingians Merovingianized this vehicle because it was a marvelous vehicle. As they utilized the Christian desire to liberate the Holy Land from the heathen, they utilized that as a means to an end that they had that was secret, this Order of Zion. And when the romances of the Grail began to take off, they were in a position to immediately utilize the Grail to cloak their communications in a society where they were on the inside in certain power positions, but on the outside looking in terms of their ultimate felt sense of destiny because they wanted to rule the world. So they used what would be to most people that were caught up in reading the Grail theory. Everybody was reading Grail romances. Everybody was telling them. Everybody was listening to them. They were as popular as Dynasty and now the Colbys and Dallas. It'd be like a revolutionary group today working out some code whereby they could sit in coffee shops and talk about Dallas and Dynasty and the Colbys, and any Secret Service individuals listening in would not know what they were talking about because they'd think they were just ordinary people gossiping about Dynasty and the Colbys. But there would be little twists in their discussions of it because they would be using it to communicate secrets. That's what I think happened with these Grail matches. But these Bagent Lee Lincoln writers, they oversimplify, and the gestalt of what I was doing in the previous half hour and will do right now is simply to drive a little wedge into the authority of their scholarship with their simple-minded utilization of the Grail theories, and what we next will see is the gospel. I'll spend more time on the gospel record because you already have a background to be able to draw your own conclusions as I show you their mistakes. But it takes a certain knowledge of the Grail romances to be able to know who's telling you the truth. If you don't know the Grail romances themselves, you can be easily misled. The tragedy of Holy Blood, Holy Grail is so few people know the Bible. They've been just as easily misled. But you know the Bible. So we'll have a demonstration of what some brains applied will do to keep a faith secure. I'm going to show you just one more thing about the Grail romances. You remember how they worked so hard to identify Keote and the heathen that carried the message to Wolfram von Eschenbach? Remember in that, in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, they identified Keote. And they identified Frigitanus, the heathen. You remember that? Okay, let's take Trevor Ravenscroft. who rather thoroughly goes into Wolfram von Eschenbach's work. There is a strict occult law, which means if these Grail romances, the European variety, were being used by members of secret occult groups to get across an occult, hermetic, mystical, or religious message cloaked in what would seem to be an ordinary romance, popularly told story, those who are involved in it, live by these occult laws. There is a strict occult law that the name of an occult master shall never be divulged. And so Wolfram refers to the unknown man who initiated him by a pseudonym, Keogh of Provence. At the conclusion of his poem, Wolfram declares that Creechin de Troyes has done violence to the original version, and that Keogh, who had the correct version, is justified in his complaint. Scholars have searched in vain for a living personality called Keogh of Provence. Well, at least this fellow would not call these people scholars, because these people found Keogh. And he says, scholars have searched in vain. They have failed to find him because they have mistaken the pseudonym for Wolfram's secret teacher. And they have made drastic errors by assuming that Wolfram had no source whatsoever and that his version is an obvious fiction, the empty swagger of a wandering minstrel. The references which Wolfram makes to Keogh throughout his poem must remain altogether puzzling to any person lacking in even the basic rudiments of occult knowledge. For instance, when Wolfram calls Keogh a lachanteur, this is usually translated as singer. The alternative and correct interpretation is magician, which is altogether unacceptable for the uninitiated. To those that are initiated, Keogh is a magician, a proper occult master. To those that don't know the codes and the language, he's just a singer. Wolfram makes his longest and most revealing references to Keogh in Book 9. In which he refers to Keogh's own sources for his tale. Quote, anyone who asked me before about the Grail and took me to task for not telling him was very much in the wrong. Am I warning you?
No,
sir. Keogh asked me not to reveal this for adventure, which means initiation. Commanded him to give it no thought until she herself adventure, the experience of initiation itself, should invite the telling, and then one must speak of it, of course. The Keogh, the well-known master, found in Toledo, discarded, set down in heathen writings, the first source of this adventure. He had first to learn the ABCs, but without the art of black magic. End quote. Wolfram even names the source of the Arabic writing he found in Toledo. It was given to Keogh by a heathen named Flegetanus. But it is as fruitless to look for a man called Flegetanus as it is to look for the so-called Keogh of Provence, or province. Flegetanus is a word which originates from ancient Persia. It means, quote, the starry script. Keogh had to learn his ABCs without the art of black magic, because his task was to read in the script of the wandering planets and fixed stars, the story of the quest for the Grail, and to confirm that this quest is a celestial mystery. Wolfram tells us how Keogh searched the chronicles of Europe to see whether there had ever been a people dedicated to purity and worthy of caring for the Grail. He read the chronicles of the lands in Britain and elsewhere, in France and in Ireland, and in Anschau he found the tale. We will describe at length later in this work that Anschau, or Anschau, is erroneously taken for Anjou, is not a physical location, but a state of transcendent consciousness. Keogh had to develop the requisite faculties to achieve that condition of higher consciousness in which the mysteries of the Grail are revealed. And I can go on and on. Many times those purveyors of the occult and the mystical, to separate themselves from demonology and the experiences sought therein, they claim to be able to attain their knowledge without the art of black magic. Now, all I again want to accomplish is, these writers would have us think that the clue to the Grail is figuring out who Keogh is personally and who Flegetanus is personally. And would so simplify it that you think that's the only search that we should undergo to try to unravel the mysteries of the Grail. Flegetanus is a key that points a direction to the source of knowledge. A study of astronomy and a study of the celestial heavens and the meanings therein. All I want as a gestalt is it's not as simple as these. They have, in essence, insulted the Grail romances by an oversimplification. Now, it is entirely possible that the Priori de Sion decided to use Keogh and Flegetanus as code words to locate certain people within their historic stream as part of their code communication. But I'm afraid Bagehot Lee and Lincoln have got the egg before the chicken instead of the other way around. The Merovingians Merovingianized the Grail romances rather than what these people are saying. Now, that's enough for the Grail, because I need to teach about 2 years on the Grail itself. I will get on to the Grail in some depth when we start talking about the history of how we got our doctrines and the very first, and what to this day is the greatest heretical threat to Christianity and its realism as presented by Christ, namely Gnosticism. The whole of the Eastern religions in the Middle East, and particularly in Egypt, and ultimately through Pergamos to Rome, and the power of those philosophic religions and mystical religions to inject themselves into Christianity, graft Christianity onto their ancient stream, and present some so-called homogenization thereof, has always been the greatest heresy facing the church. And Gnosticism was never truly met and whipped, and it's still around today. And Gnosticism, when I get on that subject and the study of the Nag Hammadi finds that give us our first real source of Gnosticism from their point of view, rather than through Justin and Arrhenius and those apologists who only told us about them in the process of destroying them, I will then talk about the Grail. But right now, my purpose was not to make you understand the Grail, but to make you understand it's not as simple as these guys tried to make it. And if you appear a bit confused, I succeeded. Now, I'm not going to go that fast when I deal with them on the Gospels. How can the Gospels, they say, on page 288, after having talked of discrepancies in the genealogy, which we blew holes in last night, after having talked about discrepancies concerning ancestry, genealogy, and the birth records, which we blew holes in last night, and I don't have to do that again, do I? They then say, how can these Gospels be unimpugnable when they impugn each other? The more one studies the Gospels, the more the contradictions between them become apparent, they say. Indeed, they do not even agree on the day of the crucifixion. Write this down, friends. According to John's Gospel, the crucifixion occurred on the day before the Passover. You got that? John, they say, has the crucifixion occur the day before Passover. That's John. Does he? Well, we'll see, won't we? According to the Gospels of Mark, Luke, and Matthew, it occurs the day after Passover. Great big discrepancy, by golly. Then, according to the Gospels, they're not in accord on the personality and character of Jesus. Lamb-like in Luke, majestic and powerful in Matthew. We blew that apart last night, so I can just go past that, can't I? And there's further disagreement about Jesus' last words on the cross. Matthew and Luke my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Just say M-G. John, simply, it is finished. Finished. Now let's look at that. See what we can do to these brilliant scholars. Given these discrepancies, they say, the Gospels can only be accepted as a highly questionable authority and certainly not as definitive. They do not represent the perfect Word of God, of any God, or if they do, God's words have been very liberally censored, edited, revised, glossed, and written, rewritten by human hands. Let's look at these know-it-alls. John, chapter 19. What did they say? He was crucified the day before the Passover. Correct? He said? Verse 13, chapter 19. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha. And it was the preparation of the Passover, about the sixth hour. And he saith unto the Jews, Behold your king. And they cried out, Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him! 16th verse, Then delivered he him therefore unto them to be crucified, and they took Jesus and led him away. Where does it say he was crucified the day before the Passover? It doesn't. But these giants, and they really were when they studied medieval history, so quickly become pea brains, through their lack of knowledge of both Hebraic and Christian facts, conclude that preparation of the Passover means the day before the Passover. Now, what is Passover? It's a day. It's an event within the day, such as the sacrificial lamb. It is a commemorative supper that Deuteronomy 16 says must occur at even, but the Hebrew literal is between the evens, between the evenings. Now let's talk about Passover. Passover is a day. Numbers 28:16, in the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord. They deduce their calendar from the moon, and when this first month of the holy year, rather than the civil year, is designated, regardless of what day of week it is, the month starts, not our Gregorian calendar, and on the 14th day of that month is Passover. It's a Hebrew day. And Passover begins, therefore, at sundown of what we would call the 13th day of that month. Do you follow that? Now, just write it down and take my word for it now. The 14th day of the month in the year in question was Wednesday. That means the evening of the 13th was 6 p.m., sundown, or thereabouts, Tuesday evening, the 13th. Passover as a day began Tuesday evening, the 13th day of the month, about 6 p.m., and continued until 6 p.m. or sundown on the 14th. That was Passover day. Deuteronomy 16 declares, sixth verse, you're to offer the sacrifice at even, literally in the Hebrew, between the evenings. He therefore allowed, God allowed, though later Jewish law set a definite time, but God allowed the Passover lamb to be offered any time between sundown the 13th, when the Passover day began, the evening that began the Passover, and the evening that ended the Passover, any time between the evens, you could offer the lamb and eat the Passover supper. Now, hear me closely. Passover is even to even, evening to evening, sundown to sundown, 13th to the end of the 14th day, Tuesday night through Wednesday night, the year in question. That's one meaning of Passover. Passover also meant the sacrificial act, the liturgical act of offering the lamb. It was a Passover ritual. The Passover meal was also called the Passover. All the people coming together for the priest to offer the Passover lamb was the Passover church service, so to speak. And Numbers 28:16-17, let me read it all. In the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord. That's the day of Passover. In the 14th day of the month is the Passover of the Lord. The Passover lamb is offered. In the 14th day of the month is the Passover of the Lord. The Passover feast is kept. And in the 15th day of this month is the feast. Which feast? The Passover feast, which is a week-long event that begins with Passover Day, which is preparation for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And on the night of the 14th, the beginning of the 15th, Wednesday night in our calendar, case that I'm telling you, the Feast of Unleavened Bread per se begins for 7 days. And Passover is the day, the sacrifice, the ritual, and the Passover meal. And Passover is also the preparation, because it is the necessary precondition for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which said Feast of Unleavened Bread is to be a response to the Passover. And you got to move from the clock, Greg. I'm sorry, but I got to watch my time there. You can't block that clock on me. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, preparation for it is the Passover. Passover puts you in a position of having your sins cleansed. It is a memorial feast of God's deliverance, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread begins at sundown at the end of the Passover. Passover starts Tuesday night, 13th, 6 p.m., ends Wednesday night, 6 p.m. at sundown. Feast of Unleavened Bread, the feast, starts sundown the 14th, the beginning of the 15th, and lasts for 7 days. And the first day after Passover, which is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread are both called in the Old Testament High Convocation Days. In the New Testament, they're called High Sabbaths. That means you can have two Sabbaths in 1 week. The day that the Feast of Unleavened Bread starts, and the ordinary Sabbath, which is always on the seventh day. I'll be right back. Holy Blood, Holy Grail, of Bajet, Lee, and Lincoln. My respect for them as historians when they deal with ordinary medieval historical fact knows no bounds. My disrespect for their treatment of Christianity is tempered by the fact that that's what most scholars do. They assume that Christianity does not require the kind of brain attention that other areas of study require. That's my private crusade to prove the contrary. Now, you may be able to go through life and say, fine, you know. He asked me how I know he lives in my heart, and have addlepated Christianity that sits in the church all the time and says amen while the preacher throws stones at the sinners that you think you're not a part of. But you're going to lose your family, you're going to lose your kids. Because they'll encounter a book like Holy Blood, Holy Grail, drop their guard with the scholarship of the first half, and assume that these knowledgeable people must know what they're saying when they say that the Gospels impugn one another. For example, they said, and I read it in the earlier half hour, John says the crucifixion occurred on the day before the Passover. And Matthew and Luke and Mark say it occurred on the day after the Passover. And we started to check them. And we started with John. And it's all based upon the 14th verse concerning the actions of Pilate. It was the preparation of the Passover in about the sixth hour, which is noon. And he said unto the Jews, behold your king. And he was crucified then on that day, which is called the preparation of the Passover. On that basis, because it's called the preparation of the Passover, these authors conclude he was crucified on the day before the Passover. Right? Let me show you. Numbers 28 lays out Leviticus 23 and Deuteronomy 16, the Old Testament foundation for the Passover. I'm going to say it and then demonstrate it. Passover of the week in question when Christ died was on Wednesday. Passover was calculated whatever year based upon the rabbi's setting of the months on a lunar calculation and the rising of the moon, the month that began the holy year would be set based upon moon calculations, and the 14th day of that month was Passover. It wouldn't matter whether Passover, the 14th day, fell on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Whatever day the 14th fell on was Passover. Got that? Their days began at sundown, 6 p.m. to 6 p.m. They didn't begin in the morning. They began at sundown. The 14th, therefore, let's assume Wednesday, was from 6 p.m. Tuesday. The evening of Tuesday to the evening of Wednesday, which starts Thursday. Got it? You started the Passover at 6 p.m. then on Tuesday, and you ended the Passover at 6 p.m. the following day, from evening to evening. The Passover, let's read it again, Numbers 28, 16, and 17. In the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord. What is the Passover of the Lord? It is the day. It is the ritual. It is the meal. You got it? And the meal was to be eaten, and it is also the sacrifice. And the sacrifice was to be offered, Deuteronomy 16 says, at even. Literally in the Hebrew, it was to be offered between the evenings. I don't know who took my black marker here, but it bothers me because this is no good. Now fix your mind. When you therefore referred to the Passover, you could, and only the context would determine, but it could loosely be referred to the way Christmas is referred to. It can mean anything from the special day to the calendar to the birth of Christ, to a Christ Mass, because that's what it means. Passover was the day, the sacrifice, the ritual, and the family meal. All of that. And it occurred between the evenings. That's why I'm going to anticipate and tell you Jesus could have his meal, the Passover meals, while still being a practicing Jew, on Tuesday evening after sundown with his disciples, go to the Garden of Gethsemane and pray, be betrayed, be arrested, go to a night trial that was illegal before Caiaphas, and be taken by sunup before Pilate and Herod, and be tried and condemned and brought to the place of crucifixion as early as 9 a.m. in the morning. Still within the frame, starting out with his supper, with Last Supper with the disciples, it's all happening between the evens. Got it? But this verse also says concerning the Passover, in the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord, and in the 15th day of this month is the feast. 7 days shall unleavened bread be eaten. In the first day shall be an holy convocation. No servile work shall be done therein. There's work done on the Passover. You sacrifice the lamb. You fix the meal. It is not under Sabbath strictures. Otherwise, you couldn't fix the meal, you couldn't sacrifice the animal, you couldn't do any of the things you have to do between the evens. The law of the Sabbath allowed none of those activities. But the Passover also was a Passover week. A whole week of Passover. And there was a feast within a feast. The feast of unleavened bread occurred within the Passover week. The Passover day occurred within the week of Passover week. And the feast of first fruits occurred within the feast of unleavened breads, all of which was within the feast of the Passover. These jerks on this subject would have us believe they understand the Passover, and they reveal their ignorance. And the evens, from even to even, was the Passover day, which was preparation for the feast of unleavened bread that occurred within the Passover week. And the first day, which would now be Thursday, starting on sundown Wednesday, was high convocation, or a high day, as the New Testament calls it, a Sabbath that was a spatial Sabbath. And as it went on for 7 days, on the seventh day of that spatial, wouldn't you know it, when I finally start to write, can you put on your checklist to check these every night and wash them off before I come live? This week, follow me closely. Passover starts on sundown Tuesday. Wednesday, between the evens, from sundown to sundown, is Passover day with the Passover events that are specific, meal, sacrifice, and ritual. Passover week includes it all, which immediately following Passover day, the Feast of Unleavened Bread within Passover week starts. And the first day and the seventh day, or the last day, of unleavened bread feasting is high day, high convocation under Sabbath law rules, spatial Sabbath. With the same rules of the Sabbath, plus a few others, that any Sabbath law requires. So Thursday becomes a spatial Sabbath that occurs once a year, the high day of the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Friday is an ordinary day. You can do whatever you want. Saturday, which is counting Passover day, 1, 2, 3, 4 days in, is an ordinary Sabbath. Sunday is the first day of the week that occurs within the framework of Passover week, and it always, the first day of the week within this Passover week, becomes a feast within a week, or a feast within a feast, the Feast of First Fruits. Now you have three feasts working, all called one feast, either Feast of Unleavened Bread or Feast of Passover, interchangeably, because it was understood that Passover was preparation for Feast of Unleavened Bread, because Moses said, you keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread in order that you might teach your children what happened that day of the Passover. And Passover was preparation for Feast of Unleavened Bread, preceded the High Sabbath, ended with the High Sabbath, and within its confines included an ordinary Sabbath and a feast of first fruits on the first day of the week as it came by. Got it? Again, all I want to point out is it ain't simple. It can be simplified, but it ain't simple. Now, where goes their theory? That John said the crucifixion occurred the day before the Passover. It occurred on the day of preparation of the Passover week. Well, I don't like the unleavened bread being called Passover. Well, he says they contradict, so let's go to Luke. Luke 22, verse 1. You got it? What'd you say? Read aloud with me. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover. Let's go to Luke 23:54. You got to read more than one chapter. The man went unto Pilate and begged the body of Jesus, is what verse 52 says. That Joseph of Arimathea getting Christ's body after he died about the ninth hour of the day. And he took it down, wrapped it in linen, laid it in the sepulcher that was hewn in stone, wherein never man before was laid. And that day, what day? The day that he died was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on. Which Sabbath? The high day, which is the first day, the holy convocation day, which is the annual Sabbath day, which is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread that must always occur on the 15th at sundown after the end of the Passover day, which was preparation for the Passover week, preparation for the unleavened bread, preparation for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was Passover, preparation for the high Sabbath day, which draws on at sundown at the end of whatever day it is. If, for example, as tradition would teach us, Christ was crucified on Friday, then Friday would have been the Passover, and Saturday, the ordinary Sabbath, would have had a double Sabbath meaning. It would have been the high Sabbath, because it was the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at the same time happening to coincide with the regular Sabbath. But if Passover occurred on any day of the week other than Friday, then you would have two Sabbaths in that year's week of Passover. You would have three, really, because you'd have the first day of unleavened bread, the last day of unleavened bread, and the regular Sabbath comes no matter what religious ritual is going on. If, for example, to belabor it, if Passover, the 14th of the month, occurred on Sunday, the first day of the week, Monday would have been the high day, the holy convocation day, the high Sabbath of the Passover week. Saturday would have been regular Sabbath. If it began on Monday, Tuesday would have been the high day Sabbath, beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread at the immediate close of Passover. Saturday would still have been an ordinary Sabbath. If it began on Wednesday, Thursday, likewise through the week. You got it? Passover wasn't the Sabbath. You didn't have to command a Sabbath for Passover. Passover stood on its own feet. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, a sacrificial symbolization of sinless living under the law. Bread without leaven in it. In the New Testament meaning of the word, the partaking of the bread, which is God and His Word, and the intake, if you will, of the Spirit of life that is without sin, which is what happens in response to faith because of grace, God puts His life in us. And that life is without sin. We, the house, still have the old man creating the conflict. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread was a response to the atoning work of Passover, the substitute sacrifice, the token for sin, the blood on the door, a total work of grace by God. It was by itself standing on its own feet spiritually. The Feast of Unleavened Bread was to begin with a Sabbath day. A high day. Now let's go back to John. Jesus has died. Verse 31. The Jews therefore, John 19, page 140, if you have a Bible like mine. The Jews therefore, because it was the preparation. naming the day. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the bodies should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day,